Good afternoon, and welcome to the EcoNews Report, a production of the North Coast Environmental Center in conjunction with KHSU, located on the campus of Humboldt State University. I am Raina Nanayel, your host for the EcoNews Report. I am the Executive Director of the North Coast Environmental Center, and our guest today is Marilee Woodhouse, co-founder of the Battle Creek Alliance. Marilee is speaking with us today about issues related to clear-cutting in the Sierra. So I understand that you are the co-founder and director of Battle Creek Alliance. Battle Creek is located near Mount Lassen, and I guess it's one of the largest tributaries of the Sacramento River and one of the few places left for wild-run salmon. Can you tell me a little about the conservation agenda of your organization?
I'm the director of the forestry program, which is what Battle Creek Alliance is about, is forestry. Well, we're working to preserve the public trust resources, which, you know, include water and wildlife. And those things, even when they are running through privately held land, don't belong to individual companies. And so what happens is the profits are made by the companies, but the costs that when things are ruined, the costs are borne by the rest of us. And, you know, one of the really important things that we've seen, not just in Battle Creek, but in a lot of different areas, is that decisions are not being made for the common good. They're being made for a small percentage of wealthy individuals, and they need to be being made for the common good.
So you are kind of watching what's happening with the resources of that particular area, specifically water, wildlife, timber, etc.
Right.
Can you tell me about some of the problems that you're facing with Sierra Pacific Industry? I understand that one of the largest loggers is Sierra Pacific Industry. Can you tell me what's happening with that right now?
Yes, they're the largest landowner in the state of industrial timberland, and they're the second largest in the nation. And there are 1.7 million acres that they own in California. And in the late 90s, they announced that they were planning to clear cut the majority of it. And they have an incredibly large economic advantage because they are so wealthy and they have a lot of power and influence on the government. So what has happened is that they've found this interesting little system where they take watersheds throughout the Sierra and the Cascades. They even go over to Trinity County as well. And they're a really incredibly wealthy and powerful company, and so they have a lot of power and influence with the government. And one of the worst things is that they're allowed to monitor their own impacts, too. So they can basically either choose or not choose to do whatever they want without really any government oversight. And what's happening, too, is that they never set baselines at the beginning of when they started clear-cutting where they could say, well, there were this many types of animals and there were this many types of plants. They never did that. And so things are being lost, and there's not any way to even tell what's being lost because of the lack of data collection.
Right. So starting in essentially what year are we looking at, the early 90s?
Well, here in Battle Creek Watershed, the first plan was filed in 1998, and so they've done 16 plans. They've filed 16 plans since then. The majority of those are cut. There are three right now that they are cutting, which are actually in litigation, but they're going ahead and cutting them anyway before the litigation is even settled.
I understand that the Sierra Club has been trying for many years to change the way timber is harvested in Battle Creek Watershed and has had very limited success due to lack of leverage in the private sphere. And this is a really good example. Sierra Pacific Industries is a great example of that. What are some of the long-term effects of clear-cutting on these watershed and forest lands?
Well, there's, of course, carbon emissions from the soil, because when you clear-cut a forest, a lot of carbon is held in the soil. So when you clear-cut, then that carbon is released from the soil, as well as losing the carbon storage of the trees themselves. And then trees basically breathe in carbon and exhale oxygen, so you lose all the oxygen production. There's the loss of biodiversity of the flora and fauna. There's a much higher fire danger in plantations. What they do is they replant in small pine plantations, mostly ponderosa pine around here. And those pines take many decades before they become at all fire resistant. So basically you have a lot of matchsticks out there for 80 years waiting to go up. Because what happens is as the tree gets older is its bark gets much thicker. So that makes it somewhat fire resistant. And also it self-limbs as it gets older. Its lower limbs start falling off. And so its lowest limbs are much higher in the air when it's older, as opposed to them being down to the ground when it's younger. So that's a major thing. And then another thing that happens is when they replant their little pine plantations, they use a lot of herbicides to keep the native species from growing back and competing with the little pine trees. And so because of that herbicide usage, most of the native plants are killed off, and the only thing that can really grow back are invasive weed species. What we see a lot of here are things like star thistle and bull thistle and mullein, and all those things are things that nobody eats.
Mm-hmm. And effects on water systems as well. What are we seeing there with regard to salmon and water quality?
I've been doing a citizens water monitoring study for the past year and a half with Battle Creek Alliance, and what we really see with that is the areas that have been cut the most recently are the ones with the highest readings in sediment. And you can see it when you go out in the storm times. The creeks are just thick with sediment in them. And another thing that's been found by other researchers is that the pool depths are getting to be less over the years. They're getting more shallow, and also there are less pools than there used to be, and that's really important for salmon and for other amphibians as well.
Mm-hmm. I have a couple quotes here from some of your colleagues. Bill Jennings, Executive Director of California Sport Fishing Protection Alliance, said, "The state's right hand is fighting the left hand, and meanwhile we are losing an invaluable resource for bringing back salmon populations. An immediate moratorium on clear cutting in Battle Creek is urgently needed," he said. And another colleague, Michael Endicott, recently wrote, "Battle Creek, like many Sierra watersheds, is being damaged by SBI's extremely aggressive clear-cutting. These waterways are essential to salmon recovery efforts and the fishing economy. Governor Brown needs to make protecting these waterways and forests a top priority before it is too late." So is this just activists gone mad, or what do we have here? Is this an extreme leftist position, or can you talk to us a little bit about the politics here?
I would call it an extremely commonsensical position to take, that you don't destroy things needlessly. And that's what's going on, is all these things, you know, you go out, if you walk out in a clear cut, it's just dead. I mean, there are little pine seedlings trying to grow back, but if you turn over rocks, there aren't any bugs under them. And it's a complete vast wasteland of death. And what happens when they clear cut is they leave an area about 300 feet between each clear cut.
Uh-huh.
That's by law. They have to leave those 300 feet. And if you go out and stand in a clear cut, you can hear that there's still some birds and things in the adjacent areas. They're called the adjacencies. And you can see all that. But the really horrible part is, it's bad enough what they've done, but by law, within 5 years or 5 years or more, they can go back and cut those adjacencies. And one of the plans that they're cutting right now is the first one to go back to cut the adjacencies. And so then you have bigger holes than there were before, and more gone. And then the habitat, I mean, right now it's fragmented by the holes being patchworked. Well, now they're becoming solid where they're cutting the adjacencies. And it's really scary.
We'll talk in a minute about thermal effects, but soil irradiation and loss of soil communities, loss of community soil structure, the pathways that roots make, the flora and fauna connected with root zones, the oxygenation of the soil, and then eventually with the heat kind of burning the soil and the erosion, it really does make replanting any kind of native plant community very challenging. I'd like to talk to you a little about thermal effects. There is some very stunning imagery on your website showing us what some of the impacts of kind of solar irradiation on clear-cut areas are. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes, I guess when you look at the soil temperature in a clear-cut as opposed to a regular forest, it's totally different, because in a regular forest you have a lot of humidity because the trees and the root systems and everything creates its own humidity, as well as lowering the temperature. And you go out in a bare open area and it's hot and dry, and that's just the way it is. I've had these arguments with some people before, and they always say, "Well, you're not a scientist." And it's like, you don't need to be a scientist. You just walk out there and you can tell.
Right. I understand that there are some complications of that as well, including a loss of water holding by the soil, loss in the microclimate of those regions. What about the effects on sensitive species?
It's not just sensitive species that suffer from this. It's every kind of species, whether it's you see it all the time or not. But certainly sensitive species tend to have little specific niches and stuff like that suffer more from when it becomes hotter and drier. And, you know, I mean, everywhere now is being hotter and drier pretty much, but you can really feel it when you go in areas where it's been clear-cut a lot. It's a whole different world up here than it used to be. I've lived here for 22 years, and it's changed so radically in that time.
What are you seeing with regard to the oaks and native shrubs in the area?
The first thing with the oaks is, oddly enough, there is no kind of law within the forest practices that they have to retain any amount of oaks. They just can leave whatever they want to or take whatever they want to. And oaks and the other kind of broadleaf shrubs are the basis of all the food networks of everything. Because even if it's, you know, even if you're talking about a deer eating oaks and or acorns and things like that, and you can say, well, a coyote or a mountain lion doesn't eat those things, but they eat the deer. So it's all connected, just like everything. And by not having even any amount of oaks that they have to leave, you're basically taking an area and taking away at least 70% of the food source. What does everybody that eat that, where do they go? Do they go to the nearest 7-Eleven and buy some acorns? You know, it's not the way it works.
And it's interesting, too, because what you're really saying is that there might be an interest in harvesting conifers for wood or for resource use. So it sounds like what you're really saying is not that no resource extraction can happen, but that when you take everything, including non-target species or non-resource species, and you remove all of that, you're completely eliminating all habitat, which, of course, would be common sense if one thinks about clear-cutting. Can you talk about the conservation organization's stance on select harvest or careful harvest?
Yeah, I mean, selection, there are a lot of problems with selection as well, but it's certainly better than clear-cutting. And, you know, really, I think at this point in the world, we really need to start looking at totally different ways of doing things than we ever have before, because obviously the ways we're doing things aren't working very well. And, you know, one of the main things is consumerism, kind of at the top of the list. Do we really need to use as much as we do? The U.S. uses between a quarter and a third of the world's timber supply, and a lot of it, about half of that, goes into packaging and disposable paper products. If you look at 100 years ago, even in this country, we didn't even use timber to make paper. You know, it was made out of linen and other things, hemp, actually, a lot of different things. And so there's really big changes needed. And, of course, it's easy to say that. It only takes a few words. It's a whole other thing to put it into practice.
And just to wrap up on the effects on sensitive species, of course, we have a lot of organisms, salamanders, frogs, our fisheries in particular, which is a whole other economic industry that are being really impacted by these activities. Many folks out there may not understand the connection between timber harvest and clear cutting and to water quality, fisheries, and watershed health in general. Can you talk about those connections and how they occur? Just give us a background on how water quality, temperature, turbidity, in-stream habitat, riparian conditions are all kind of related.
Well, you know, basic hydrology 101 is that water flows downhill. You know, that's not really high level of scientific knowledge either. You go outside when it rains, you watch it, you see it. But actually, in a lot of scientific studies, they found that roads are a larger source of sedimentation than clear cuts even. And unless it's, if you're talking about a really steep slope and different things like that, then there are a lot of variables. But nonetheless, roads are oftentimes the worst culprit. You have to look at, within a watershed, you have to look at the road density per square mile, because oftentimes within 1 square mile of area, there can be 5 to 10 miles of roads, and that's true of around here. There is very high density of roads around here, and that's unpaved logging roads, dirt roads. And so what happens when it rains really hard is rainfall hits the ground, hits the hard-packed dirt of the road, especially if it's sloped and it certainly has no vegetation on it. And the particles of dirt and whatever chemicals are attached to them start moving, and eventually a gully forms in the road, and then that also directs the water downhill to wherever the nearest runoff place is. A lot of times it'll be man-made ditches, sometimes it's water bars in the road, sometimes it's just natural gully erosion. There are all different ways that water gets down to the creeks and the tributaries and then flow into the main creek. But what happens is it eventually gets down there. And as those particles collect, they get the water dirty, and they fill the pools in and make the stream beds more shallow. So in the summertime, that means that the water is warmer because the stream bed is more shallow and it's not got the depth to cope with the sun. And so that affects fish and other amphibians' ability to survive, because most of them can't take very much change in temperature. As the temperature goes higher, they die, or certainly their eggs do, and sometimes they themselves too. Then if you look at when it rains really hard, which this country is really good for that where I live, and also the type of soil is very erosive here, but when you look at when it rains really hard, the force of the water carries all this into downstream areas, I mean miles away, down to the Sacramento River, which Battle Creek is the tributary of. So that creates a heavy silt accumulation, and that sedimentation that is making that silt pollutes the water supply, and it clogs the filtration systems that all the municipal water places have to use to purify the water for the municipal citizens. And that creates more cost for them. And so that is another example of timber companies getting the profits where someone else is paying for the expenses.
Mm-hmm. This is really interesting. It sounds like this relates to some of what we've talked about, what I know that you look into with regard to creation of sub-watersheds, how resource professionals and industries have a benefit in looking at sub-watersheds or delineating watersheds as a way to separate them from the project site. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
In this particular, in Battle Creek watershed, they've subdivided the contiguous area where there are the 16 different timber harvest plans that cover almost 20,000 acres. They've subdivided it into 9 separate sub-watersheds. They've used the tributaries of Battle Creek as the sub-watersheds, even though the definition of a watershed is that it's a body of water that all the other water flows into, and it carries the surface water down to the next biggest place, which in this case is the Sacramento River. So the tributaries of Battle Creek are not separate watersheds. They're part of the Battle Creek watershed, but that's how they've gotten around the California Environmental Quality Act regulations that they look at the cumulative impacts of associated projects. They've done that by using a sub-watershed system, and so that way they don't have to look at all the projects together, which is specifically against the law.
A really good take-home message there for citizens and just folks in the area is that it might seem like it's an issue related to your bioregion or your city or your municipality, but the effects are far-flung. They're far-reaching. What happens in Battle Creek affects people in Sacramento, affects people in San Francisco, Bay Delta, that kind of thing. So,
and L.A.
And Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So that's a really important point that you've made. And on that note, economically, what are we losing? What is at stake by clearing our forests globally and locally in terms of ecosystem services or future resources, public trust?
Well, there was a report that was done, commissioned by the European Union several years ago, and it was at the time when the banking crisis first hit, and it said that what we're losing in forest loss just makes the banking crisis look puny. It makes it meaningless because they estimated that the annual cost of forest loss is between $2 trillion and $5 trillion every year. And that figure comes from adding the value of the various services that forests perform. They provide clean water and they absorb carbon dioxide. And as the forests decline, then the services that they're providing for free are lost and they have to be paid for somewhere, like I was saying, with, you know, in the municipalities, the water has to be purified and that costs money and equipment and all different things. So there's an amazing assortment of costs involved.
How are healthy forests related to having sustainable supplies of clean water, just to give people a really good background, aside from just what we've already discussed? How do forests act as storehouses for water?
First of all, a forest cycles water through the soil into groundwater, and then, or sometimes some of it goes into surface water too. But if you have a forest, when the rain hits the trees, it kind of disperses it, so it falls slowly to the ground, and then it moves into the soil and eventually gets into the underground aquifers. A lot of the water that we're using now is called fossil water because the aquifers are so old that some of the water in them may be 2,000 years old. It's incredible. But then there are higher aquifers too, which are newer, but nonetheless, they have to recharge, and the way that they recharge is through the forest filtrating the water down through the soil, their root systems keeping it from running off and letting it percolate, slowly percolate into the soil. And without that, you know, in a clear cut, none of that happens. It's just washing off really fast. And so what you see is that the flow of water is higher in the early parts of the year, like the springtime or possibly the wintertime too. So there's much more flow at that time, but that's not when you need it. You need that water to be flowing in the summertime when it's the hottest and the driest, and it's all gone by then if there's nothing to hold it and keep it percolating through the soil slowly.
And that's really where we see, and it has really been under-publicized, but tremendous fish kills that happen in many of the California watersheds that don't receive publicity. Juvenile salmon that are just experiencing fish kills every year during the dry season. But another thing that comes to mind is aquifer and groundwater shrinkage.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting phenomenon that can happen where you won't really get the size of your aquifer, your groundwater area back. So that's something for the listeners to think about.
Yeah.
Is it common for large tracts of forest to be sprayed with pesticides and herbicides? I know that you said that it was something that Sierra Pacific Industries engaged in. Is this a common practice across the board?
It is for timber companies on private land, yes. As far as I know, the Forest Service has really reduced their amount of herbicide use, but it is still being used a lot on private forest land.
And I was actually not aware of that to the extent that it occurs, so I think that's something that many of the listeners might be surprised by.
I was surprised by it when I first started learning about this.
Mm-hmm. And I understand, too, that there is a taxpayer-funded fish restoration effort, $128 million taxpayer-funded Battle Creek Salmon and Steelhead Restoration Project, that much of this clear-cutting is negatively affecting. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
All of the clear-cut land is directly upstream of the area that's being restored with the fish restoration project. SPI owns in this part of the watershed, the watershed goes all the way down to between Red Bluff and Redding area, so it's quite a few miles away. But in about 10 linear miles up here, right above the restoration project, SPI owns the majority of the land. I don't know the exact percentage, but it's probably at least 80%, maybe more close to 90%. And so all of that upland use has been basically ignored while the restoration project is going on directly downstream of it. And there was a report done in the early 2000s about it. There was some fisheries biologist that was hired to do work for the Battle Creek Watershed Conservancy, which is a different group than ours. And he spoke of that a lot. And that information, SPI is a board member of the Conservancy. And they went to the Conservancy and they asked for that information to be left out. And it was. It was left out of the report. All of the things about road density and the pool depth and all those things that said that there were serious upland problems.
For people out there who would like to get involved, it seems clear that if they are taxpayers funding a large restoration project, but industry is kind of adversely affecting that same project, they're just putting money into money. I have a quote here from you. It says, "This enormous taxpayer-funded effort to save Battle Creek is being sabotaged by Sierra Pacific Industries. The Department of Forestry and Fire Protection and other regulators are circumventing the law by not requiring SPI to conduct a full watershed-wide assessment of the cumulative impacts of their ecologically destructive logging." That pretty much says it. With regard to the Department of Forestry and Fire, would you like to talk about their handling of this or their involvement? Of course, you know, we know that agencies are very strapped with funding right now, but just to talk about what you'd like to see from them.
Just to actually do the cumulative impact that is required by law. That was the purpose of, it's the heart of the California Environmental Quality Act, is that cumulative impacts be addressed, and it has not been done here, and it hasn't been done in other watersheds either.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, the sub-watershed system has been the way that they've circumvented that. It's basically CEQA, the Environmental Quality Act, and the other different forestry laws and all the different laws and rules and regulations are basically blockades on the road saying you can't go here because it's too destructive. And so by circumventing that, the timber companies are just driving around those roadblocks and going on and doing whatever they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the purpose of the laws, was to stop that, and they're not being enforced, not by CAL FIRE and not by the courts.
Let's talk a little bit about Sierra Pacific carbon sequestration in California forests. That was a report that they wrote. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. It wasn't published or peer-reviewed, but yes, they put it out as a white paper, what's called a white paper.
What can you tell me about that report?
Well, when it was reviewed by somebody outside of it, shall I read you what they said?
Sure.
Okay. So it was reviewed by NRDC, and what their conclusion was, as detailed below, the SPI study raises numerous methodological and policy issues that call into question both quantitative conclusions and the value of those conclusions for the development of climate policy. A critical review of the study demonstrates that, contrary to the report's conclusions, replacing existing diverse forests with uniform tree plantations is unlikely to produce net carbon benefits and will instead increase the risk of catastrophic fire and threaten the extensive range of benefits provided by the existing forest ecosystems. Methodological problems with the SPI study include the following. The SPI analysis is based on a non-peer-reviewed statistical model. While the authors acknowledge that their model violates normal statistical conditions, they reject alternative unbiased approaches because they would be, quote unquote, tedious.
So to put a nice wrapper on that for us, go ahead and just talk to us about that briefly.
The few studies that we've dealt with are so-called studies that SPI puts out, have always had this underneath them is that they tweak everything to make it come out the way they want to, but they don't actually do it in an unbiased manner. And that's the purpose of any kind of study or science, is to take the bias out of it as much as possible so that it's accurate as possible. But if you start tweaking it around and taking certain things out so it changes the results, then it really has no basis in science or reality.
Mm-hmm. And on a related note, I know that SVI and various other timber harvest companies are looking at and have been utilizing the cap and trade and carbon offsets. What can you tell us about what cap and trade is, how it works, and what's going on with SPI and Battle Creek watershed with regard to that?
Cap and trade is very complicated, and I don't know that I'm the person to talk about that. But what it basically does is it monetizes the natural resource systems and sells credits to polluters in order. So, I mean, you know, like say there's some oil refinery down in the Bay Area that's putting off a lot of emissions, and they can't figure out any way to stop that. Well, then they can buy credits from somebody else that is doing something that's anti-emissions, supposedly, and use that as an offset. But what SPI has done is they've inserted themselves into this cap and trade program as providers of offsets, because they say that by clear cutting, then when they replant their little tiny tree plantations, then they can sell those replanted trees as offsets, even though they clear cut the standing forest of, you know, 80 to 100-year-old trees that are really big and well-grown. So it's just, I mean, that's about as much as I can explain it. It's very tricky.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. I know that there have been some recent developments. Center for Biological Diversity had released a press release back in 2010, and there were some issues regarding the California Air Resources Board not asking people to look into other options besides cap and trade. And I know that this is kind of how business is done, so I appreciate you giving us some information on that. Many of the activists and advocates in the area would like to maybe know what they can do today. What would you ask local citizens to do today?
You know, right now we're working on trying to get the governor and secretary of natural resources, John Laird, to step in and put some kind of moratorium on this and require that the cumulative impacts analysis be done, among other things. And so we do have different emails going to them and different letters signed on to and things like that. And so the easiest way to contact, we ourselves have a website, which is www.thebattlecreekalliance.org. You have to put the in because without it was sold already. So you have to put that part in. And that actually has John Laird and Jerry Brown's, one of their email addresses, and then it has their phone numbers and mailing addresses. But if you go to the Pelican Network.
And I have that here, www.pelicannetwork.net/stopclearcut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that has a really easy way where all you have to do is fill in your information and write whatever you want to write, and it will be sent directly to Brown and Laird. And so that's a really huge thing because, honestly, you know, the whole forestry issue does not have thousands and thousands of people getting involved in it. It's not like some issues where, you know, 50,000 people will send emails and stuff like that. We don't have that many, unfortunately. And so, you know, every single person that sends in helps because we need to have a showing of mass indignation about this.
So I understand that it's been difficult for many of the environmental groups to get some forward momentum going like they did with the federal government timber harvest. Marilee, are you familiar with the forest ethics thing that went on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually worked with them when I first started.
So I understand that one of the problems is, or the difference between working with someone like Sierra Pacific Industries and the federal government's timber harvest, is that it's hard to get them involved because you can't influence them through their shareholders to bring pressure on management.
Right.
Activists have been able to work with the federal government and the state government by getting people involved and getting citizens to write in. But with a privately held corporation, it's difficult to work with them. I understand that Forest Ethics, an organization that specializes in market-based campaigns, attempted to work with Sierra Pacific Industries. What was the outcome of that, or what were some of the problems with that?
Essentially, SPI just they just sort of told them their same spiel that they tell everybody, that, oh, we're sustainable and we're working to protect the environment and blah, blah, blah. They don't listen because nobody makes them. That's the sad thing, is their owner has over a couple of $1 billion, and he's one of the richest men in the world. So, you know, he really doesn't have to listen to what people say as long as he's able to do what he wants to do.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that many of the ecological organizations and activists have tried to get the California legislature to sponsor a bill to end clear cutting in California, and that while they have occasionally managed to get someone to sponsor a bill from time to time, it's always gone nowhere due to the effectiveness of SPI in influencing legislative committee members or governors. Is that factual?
Yes, as far as I've seen, bags of money always work better than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I've spoken to a number of people over the years, and one of the people I spoke to was a researcher who's been doing research for a long time on watersheds and clear cutting and things like that. And one of the things he said to me at some point was that SPI had owned the last five governors. This was before Brown was elected, but he said that SPI had owned the last five governors, and that as long as that was true, that nothing was going to change.
So what can we do politically?
Got me. I was quite shocked to see recently in an editorial in the Sacramento Bee that Jerry Brown has gotten quite a bit of money from SPI also. I did not expect that. So, you know, I honestly don't know. I wish I had the answer to that.
We can get involved. We can send letters. We can support our local advocacy organizations. What can we do as consumers?
As consumers, you can, you know, really pay attention to what you're using and not, you know, really try to cut down how much you use. It's hard to do, I know, because, you know, I think about it sometimes. And when I was a kid, you know, if you bought a bottle of aspirin, it didn't come in a box with five other things wrapped around it and everything like that. It came in a bottle. That was it. everything has become more user. I mean, everything you buy has so much wrapping and so much packaging and all these things, and, you know, and everybody loves the disposable napkins and paper towels and all these things. And, you know, it's like, we have to not do this anymore. I mean, we're I think 5%, the U.S. is 5% of the world's population, and we use a third to, you know, a quarter to a third of the world's timber. There's, you know, that's not fair, you know. If nothing else, you have to look at that and say, well, how does this work that we get to use this much over everybody else, and especially when everything is disappearing so quickly?
You said about half of that is used for disposable paper products, which is really time to take a long, hard look at ourselves and our habits. But part of that goes back to us understanding where things come from and having some sort of connection to what the consumer product is.
Yeah.
And I know that we you and I have talked briefly about commodifying credits, carbon credits, or some sort of credits for things is just another form of commodification. What we really have to do is look at our commodifying view of nature and really start to change that.
Yeah.
I really want to thank Marilee Woodhouse from the Battle Creek Alliance, and you're coming on today. If you would like to get involved with the Battle Creek Alliance, you can do so at www.thebattlecreekalliance.org. You can also go to www.pelicannetwork.net/stopclearcut. And thank you so very much for all of the work that you're doing for the public trust and keeping forests preserved. Thank you very much, Marilee.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
You're welcome. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
This has been the Econews Report, and my name is Raina Nanayel, and I've been your host for the past half hour. I was speaking with Marilee Woodhouse from the Battle Creek Alliance. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again at the KHSU website under archived programs at khsu.org. The EcoNews Report is produced from KHSU, located at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Thanks to our engineer, Fred McLaughlin. Please join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the EcoNews Report.